Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I'm delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Judith Newman, who together with Alan Hornblum and Gregory Dober is the author of Against Their Will, The Secret History of Medical Experimentation on Children in Cold War America. Judy Newman, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you.
I was thrilled to find out about this book, which is brand new. I have been hoping that someone would write such a book because you're constantly hearing about these stories one by one, bit by bit. The story from Tuskegee, the story from Guatemala, the story from a hospital in New York or a hospital in Pennsylvania, and they're always treated as aberrations. And
right.
I was hoping someone would collect them. was that the motivation here?
It was one of the motivations, certainly, was to collect a vast number of published research studies that have been done for many, many decades by medical researchers in the United States, and call them together, but also provide a context for them, which I think we effectively do in the book in the first several chapters by speaking about some of the motivations that may have been behind some of this research. We don't call them justifications, but motivations. The other thing I think, David, that differs here, which was terribly important to me, is that this book is exclusively about research with children, with minors, which is another interesting research ethical topic because of the greater vulnerability of a child in any research study as compared to an adult participant in terms of consent and risk and harm. And so that, I think, is also different than the ones that you mentioned. Tuskegee and some of the hospital studies that are more well-known were with vulnerable populations, but with adult populations. So I think the book is distinguished by its focus on minor children and especially vulnerable children at that.
You do indeed start the book with information about the popularity of eugenics in the United States in the 1920s and the 1930s, at which point you say, or you quote someone claiming that perhaps three-quarters of U.S. colleges in the 1930s were teaching eugenics. Can you talk about how widespread that was and what the relationship then is to experimentation?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, as someone who teaches developmental psychology myself, and certainly I very much focus on the importance of genetics and prenatal development as contributors to how we all turn out, I think that the difference with eugenics focus in the first several decades of the 1900s was the notion that biology is determinism, that biology determines all, and that therefore you want good-gened people to be in the population and bad-gened people to not be in it or to at least not be able to reproduce in it. So our argument was that you begin to think of people as being bad-gened, which much of the reasoning was not based on any good research evidence anyway, but the notion that a criminal or someone who was mentally delayed or someone who really in any was poor, you know, that this was because of bad genetics, completely because of bad genetics, led to decades of forced sterilizations. And what we focus on is not so much the sterilizations, because we were speaking more about experimental research, but the fact that you start to devalue populations by assuming that they are lesser gened persons and not as worthy. And I think that gave some very well-intentioned, I believe, medical doctors and researchers this sense that there were populations that it was okay to use in this way for research because, you know, if things didn't work out perfectly, these were not populations that we had to be that concerned about, and no one really was concerned about them. So there'd be no one really advocating for orphans or mentally delayed children in state homes or in state institutions or hospitals. And so I think it was the sense that there was no consent to be gotten or no voice to be heard that made these children, especially mentally delayed and poor, children and orphans to be seen as lesser than. They were sort of the step between doing research on animals and research on humans is what we sort of came away from much of this with, that this was the sort of in-between stage.
I live in Charlottesville, Virginia, where there's a historical marker on the street about the fact that sterilization was legal here from in the state of Virginia from 1924 to 1979.
Right, to 79, and the legislation started in the 60s to make this illegal. We found some Native American sterilizations continued well into the late 70s as well. It's hard to believe, isn't it? I mean, I was teaching already. I was out of graduate school when and I don't think I knew anything about it. I think that's what's so shocking, is here I am, a well-educated person, and I've been teaching ethics forever. My degree was in child development. My own dissertation was research on children, and I think even I was somewhat shocked by what the last few years revealed to me, and I know that my co-authors feel the same way, even though Alan Hornblum, the first author, had done an outstanding book on a similar topic having to do with research exploitation of prisoners, published in 1998, a book called Acres of Skin, in which he focused on Philadelphia prisons and the research that was done. Similarly, the notion of no consent, much harm, and a devalued population. So we just took that a step further to another devalued population, which children, you know, who were seen as lesser than. And maybe in some ways researchers thought that this is a way these populations could make a contribution by being research participants, or as they called them, subjects. Sometimes they called them material. Sometimes they called them volunteers, which is somewhat ridiculous, given that they weren't really volunteering. They were even sometimes referred to as inmates, the children in these studies, because they were seen as inmates of their, institutions. And so in the studies, instead of seeing the word subjects, which is, to me, an awful enough word, I like to use the word participant, we'd see words like research material, and it would be a description of the children, or inmates, and it would be a description of the children. So it belies a whole way of thinking, I think.
What's an example or two of some of the physical experiments performed on children in the mid-20th century?
Well, what we did, given that there was so much, and so much that's not even in the book, because it became necessary to just sort of give a sampling of a few areas that we felt would get the point across of the exploitation that we felt was going on. So what we did is after we gave the context, which we felt was eugenics, you're absolutely right that was a piece. We also, as you know, had an introductory chapter on what we sort of consider the hero worshiping of doctors, so that we allowed them to do things because we thought they knew better, and that they would never do anything that would be harmful. So we speak about that as a bit of the context. We also talk about the Cold War. That's why that term is in the title, because we speak about this sense of patriotism that you had to do for your country by being in these research studies. And much of the research did have to do with radiation and mind control. And so we then followed with several chapters about the actual, as you say, the physical, or I even added, as the psychology person, a few chapters on psychological treatment and psychological research. So we have many, many studies having to do with vaccinations, where children in these institutions were exposed to diseases that they didn't necessarily have, to test vaccines. And we have benefited from much of that research, certainly the polio vaccine. I think our point isn't that there shouldn't have been research. The issue for us is, why were these the folks chosen to be part of the research? Why didn't they go to, wealthy children living together maybe in a boarding school if they thought it was convenient to go where several children were all together, as opposed to these particular children where there were not parents to consent or there were not literate parents who could consent. And so I think for us it wasn't that we're against research. We certainly think that much of the research we reported on was vital research. It's for us the issue of who was included and that the risks weren't explained and that informed consent was not granted. So there were loads of studies on vaccines. There were there's a chapter on research having to do with diet, dental studies, as well as studies having to do with skin conditions. There's a radiation chapter. There's a chapter on psychological treatment, including electric shock therapies, LSD. Lobotomy is a large part of our book. Lobotomies on children back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s to be doing brain surgery on a child's brain because they were presenting some behavior problems is something that I, in 2013, as a psychology person, just find it almost impossible to believe even happened. And then we have a chapter on psychological abuse, and the only study in the entire book, I would say, that was an unpublished study appears in that chapter. It's actually now been referred to as the Monster Study. It wasn't one that involved anything physical per se, but it's an interesting study. If I can just summarize it briefly, this was a study that was done by a person who actually ran a department at a major university. He himself was a stutterer. His name was Wendell Johnson. He was a stutterer, and he believed that his stuttering was not due to a glitch in his brain. He believed it had to do with the way his first grade teacher and his parents responded to his early attempts at speech. And so he decided to go to an orphanage in Iowa, right near his university, and have a graduate student begin her master's thesis in this orphanage, where they divided some of the orphans into an experimental group and others went into a control group. The experimental group, whenever they uttered a sound, the graduate student as well as staff were directed to sort of mock the child, tell them to spit it out, tell them that, you know, they're stupid and that they sound like a stutterer. And the attempt was to create stuttering in these individuals, to actually see if you could create a stutterer. And in some cases, they indeed did. The research never was published because some of the other graduate students said in the early 40s, how dare we publish this when we're actually trying doctors, you know, for doing medical research during the Holocaust in Germany, that this doesn't really sound too dramatically different from in terms of using people in this way and creating a negative result. And so it never got published. But then, as often happened in the cases that we talk about in the book, it was an investigative journalist that often was the whistleblower, the one who revealed what was going on years later. And so in 1965, a journalist revealed this, and many of the children who were now older adults found out that they had been in the study, which explained their speaking impairments, their low self-esteem, their self-consciousness, because the students in the control group, the children in the control group, did not have similar outcomes. And so there were lawsuits, and as in other of the cases that we report, there have been lawsuits following the revelations. But that was one where there was no physical invasion. There were no viruses injected. There were, no major blood tests being taken every day during the experiment. But it still was psychologically invasive and had significant outcomes throughout their lives. And they didn't know they were part of a study, which is the point that we were making in the entire book, is these folks often did not know they were even participating in research.
We are speaking with Judith Newman, who is an author of an incredible new book called Against Their Will, and she has been describing one of many powerful stories in that book. Clearly, there were victims who suffered for a lifetime. There were children who were severely damaged physically, and there were children who were killed. I'm sure there's no accurate statistics to tally the damage, but it's interesting that you bring up the prosecution of Nazis who were put in prison and in some cases hanged for these types of experiments in 1947 while the United States was giving people syphilis in Guatemala.
Right.
At the Pennhurst School in Pennsylvania in the book, children are being fed hepatitis-laced feces to eat as an experiment for the good of science. Talk about how, if at all, the Nuremberg Code and the prosecution of the Nazis for offensive behavior impacted ongoing offensive behavior here in the land of the free.
Well, that is, you know, one of the driving forces behind us doing the book was we just we were struck by what looked like such hypocrisy of us being the judge and jury in a sense, and yet negative research, and we don't want to say that all research is negative. We certainly know that much research was being done in which consent was received even before it was mandated by law to do so. I mean, we were just making the point that even though ethics were not legislated in the early part of the 1900s the way they were in the last few decades, we just felt that doctors who have always, we thought, been instructed to do no harm would consider that as their main justification for doing anything, is to make sure that no harm was done. So we certainly see the difference between some of the research that we reported and what was done during the Holocaust in terms of outcome. But what we realize is that this whole notion of eugenics, but also the sort of the end justifies the means kind of thing, is not what ethical research should be guided by. Ethical principles like non-maleficence or do no harm, like justice, which is that you don't discriminate and choose certain people to be in your study but not others, like autonomy, where people have the right to choose. And those were basic principles in the Nuremberg Code. But what we found is that many doctors say that the code either was not known to them, that it was not made known. It was just something out there that got written up but was never really put out there for doctors to view as something that they needed to follow. Other doctors that we interviewed said that that was for those horrible, you know, researchers who were doing such dreadfully savage things. This had nothing to do with us and with what we were doing. And I think that's the... that's that justification where you sort of you think that your research is so important. If you're the first to discover that cure, the first to see what the effects of radiation are should there be an atomic bomb, this will be so important for the greater good. I think there's just this notion that if the greater good can benefit from your research, the fact that a few might be sacrificed in the process is something that we just have to kind of see as part of moving forward. Our feeling was that animal research could have been done in a lot of these cases, and even that certainly has its ethical issues, but that we are okay with research being done when you are getting consent, when you are fully honest about the risks, and we just didn't see that level of truthfulness and consent getting. What we saw is vulnerable populations being used. In some cases, it was true that there were outbreaks in the institutions of a disease that needed some control, but we just felt that much of what we found went above and beyond controlling the crisis and moved into that area of exploiting individuals who were otherwise okay and did not need your intervention. We're okay when intervention is to benefit someone, but it's when it's simply non-therapeutic, when it's simply for your experimental goals, that was where we questioned it.
Curtis LeMay, who led the United States firebombing of Japanese cities, burned many cities to the ground, famously said that if the Allies had lost World War II, he would have been prosecuted as a war criminal.
Yeah.
Do you conceivably, are there doctors who could have said the same?
Well, I'm not sure in this case that this... I don't know that this rises to the level of criminality. What I was using in my own piece of this three-authored work was my own background in ethics and my notion that research should be guided by ethical principles, not by the goal. So instead of a teleological or utilitarian view of research, which is that the end does justify the means, I always instruct my students that these ethical principles of do no harm and of truthfulness and of autonomy or consent or volunteerism must be at the heart of it, that there is no one research study that's worth violating those ethical principles. I think for me it's really about ethical violations, but we were surprised that there were not more whistleblowers along the way, and that's something we all know that being a whistleblower has its negative repercussions, but we were struck by the fact that so many studies did appear in print in which harm was clearly done to these children, and we don't think that people were standing up and saying no, 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 although there may have been studies that never did come to fruition because someone stood up and said no, no, no. One can only hope so. We also have a chapter on what we call research misconduct, where instead of it being that children were directly harmed throughout the research study, we speak about researchers who have been known to fudge or fabricate the data after they did the research study, such that when they publish the results, they are not, in fact, accurate results, and that other doctors, practitioners, may then use the results of that false research to treat their children in their practices. And that was something, even the very, very well-known case of Andrew Wakefield, who has argued that autism is related to a particular vaccine, even though hundreds of replications showed no such effect. He then came out years later after his 1998 study to say that his little study with 12 children, he had actually fabricated some of that data, so that you have, you know, parents not wanting to vaccinate their children based on a study with 12 children that's never been replicated and now is found to be based on false data. And the repercussions of that are enormous in terms of children getting measles and, you know, others of the diseases that the vaccine includes. So while I don't know that these are crimes, people have lost their licenses to practice medicine based on research misconduct. I don't know that they've lost their licenses because of the kinds of things that we focused on, which is just harming children in studies. But they certainly could be seen as not rising to the level of professional standards, I would think.
Well, I would think giving people hepatitis and syphilis and radiation has long been thought, at least on some level, as immoral and illegal. I'm curious, during the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, how widespread was human experimentation in the United States? Was it growing? Was it shrinking? You cite a statistic that in 1970, a third of National Institutes of Health grants required human experimentation. Now, I assume some percentage of that is proper consensual, but I don't know.
Well, in the 1970s, and you mentioned Tuskegee, it was in the early 70s that the Tuskegee revelations came about. And, you know, the 60s was certainly a decade of human rights movements in this country, so that the idea of humans having rights was out there. It was in the 70s, especially the late 70s, that you start seeing federal legislation that requires not only informed consent from parents when you're involving children in research, but actually getting assent, approval from the child to be part of the study after the parent has been informed and consented. So this was from the late 70s. Also around that time is when you start to see universities beginning to do the institutional review board proposal review, so that any research study that I put together has to be reviewed, and I am not able to meet with one child until I get approval from this university institutional review board, which is very, very knowledgeable about every ethical legislative piece and makes sure that no child's rights are being violated. And that even includes, like, the incentives that you give a child for being in your study, that they can't be unreasonable and beyond what the child normally receives in their life, or else they are being forced to be in the study, and it's not consensual. But, you know, when you say about the level of crime, I just want to go back to that, David, because the truth is, you know, at this point in time, we certainly understand the harms of radiation, and we understand that possibly injecting or affecting with the virus seems to be such a negative. But in the context of when these studies were being done, I mean, some of that we know because of this research. I think the researchers themselves, Saul Krugman, for example, at Willowgrove, who was Willowbrook, who was infecting children with hepatitis, for example, was arguing that by controlling the infection, they would have a lesser outbreak of it than if they were getting it the way all of the other children in the institution were getting it, because it was spreading so contagiously. So that there was this notion that what they were doing was actually good for the kids. We argue that, you know, we are not so sure of that, and especially because of the way we felt that children were coerced to be in these studies. Parents were told, for example, that there was no room at the institution for their child unless they came into the research study. So we were focusing on the violation of ethical principles throughout these studies. In terms of, has there been an increase over the years in human research? Absolutely. You know, certainly the pharmacological fields, psychopharmacological fields, in order to be able to get approval, things have to move from the animal level to the human level. So for sure, our concern now is that, given that we have ethical legislation in this country that hopefully is reducing unethical research, our concern, as we say in the last chapter of the book, is that research might be being taken, we know, we cite some examples of it being taken abroad in countries where there are less rigorous ethical principles being enforced, and our concern is that some of the same issues are now occurring in less well-developed countries with less well-developed ethical codes, and so we don't want to ignore that just because it's not the United States. This offshore research concerns us greatly as well.
That's perhaps the most disturbing bit in the book, is that conclusion that perhaps we haven't just outsourced child labor and sweatshops and weapons testing and other things that we like to think we've abolished. Mm-hmm. We may have outsourced human experimentation, which I have to assume is done in part with something other than the best of intentions. Just as you point out so well in the book, it was not typically the privileged or the wealthy or the white children who were experimented on supposedly for their own good. Rather, it was the most vulnerable with the fewest rights.
And I think sometimes in this country or abroad, populations, especially who are unlikely to be able to receive treatment otherwise, sometimes perceive these experimental treatments as treatment. It's what in the field they call the therapeutic misconception, that the parent may consent, thinking that this is treatment without fully understanding the risk. And you can see where that is more likely to happen in the populations who we were describing, that there would be this sense that this is the only treatment that they can possibly get, so they will agree to have their child be part of it. That we certainly are concerned about. And in truth, these pharmaceutical companies especially need many, many, many persons in their sample sizes to have the results be significant enough statistically to be able to receive their approval. So they need lots of persons. They need lots of individuals to be enrolled in these studies. And that is, of course, you know, concerning in terms of these offshore studies and where they're taking place now, and our concern about literacy and whether people are understanding what it is that they're participating in.
We have been speaking with Judith Newman. The book, which you should run out and get right now, is called Against Their Will: The Secret History of Medical Experimentation on Children in Cold War America. The authors are Alan Hornblum, Judith Newman, and Gregory Dober. Judy Newman, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
You are so welcome. I'm glad that we had the chance to speak to some of these very important issues, David. Thank you.
Thank you. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.